It's Elmer Witt and Leo Bustin addressing a subject of loneliness, our worst disease. And I'm really uptight about this because I've never done this before, and I'm over 67 years old. And as Ellis said, well, you've probably never been lonely. That's why you didn't do it. The other thing, I usually go by the concordance to the Bible, and loneliness isn't in the concordance. I guess one of the reasons I'm uptight is that I usually have a security blanket when I speak. And that's a bunch of slides, usually 80. And they're a real security blanket. Today, for the first time in 67 years, I have one slide. And that's why I'm shook up, I guess. But I have good support. It was last week that Elmer Witt, who is director of Holden Village, for you who are new here, and I said, you know, we should do something on loneliness because it is our worst disease. And I've been wanting to do it for a long time. I've announced several times that I was going to do it, and I never did do it. And so I'm feeling pretty guilty about that. And ever since I purchased a book, I think it's 25 years old now, Paul Tournier, from Escape from Loneliness, and he's a friend. In fact, I'll be referring probably to two books. We'll be referring to two of his books. And I used one of them, Creative Suffering, when we talk about suffering. But ever since I got this, so I'll be using this. Some will be using this. And the other one, more recent book, from an acquaintance of mine named Lynch, James Lynch, The Broken Heart, The Medical Consequences of Loneliness. You can probably understand why Elmer Witt is interested in loneliness. If you listened last night to a very moving sermon where he was recalling his conversation with a very dear friend, Joe Sittler, a remarkable, remarkable fellow, who I've also privileged to know. And you remember that Elmer referred to community, to fellowship, to filling space, filling voids. You see, as director of Holden Village, one of his chief concerns and assignments, and much of his effort, is directed to cure, to relieve, or prevent the disease we're talking about today. That's one of the main principles of this place. And in addition to that, not only doing something with those who come here who suffer from loneliness, but also to teach those of us who are here how to deal and help those people. And that's why I wanted him to be here with us today, and that's why I'm sure he wanted to be here. Now, I'm approaching this in a very unorthodox way, which is probably, those who know me, those of you who know me, know that's predictable. But I was going to say that in Escape from Loneliness, I read the dedication, and Paul Tournier, it was to his friends, and he dedicated because it was a mark of affection and admiration for their effect in restoring the sense of community and fellowship in Switzerland, which is what you talked about last night. Now, I'm trained as a veterinarian, and my PhD is in physiology from a medical school. And I tell you that because although I'm a bioscientist who emphasize animals, and you probably wonder why that is, but I hope it becomes evident before I quit. But I have been a professor in schools of medicine and veterinary medicine, both. And first I'll define what loneliness is by example. from animals. And those of you who have gone through Montana or live in Montana, never been at Fort Benton, you know there's a statue there to a dog, Old Shep. And Old Shep belonged to a sheepherder. They were very closely bonded, but the sheepherder died. And so they took his body into the railroad station, put it on the train, which the dog witnessed, because the dog accompanied him to the train. But then the dog, nobody wanted him, he set up housekeeping under the decking of the Fort Benton Railroad Station. And for the next 5.5 years, met every train that came into that station, seeking his master. After 5.5 years, he slipped on the ice and snow and fell under a train and was killed, or else he committed suicide. He was suffering from loneliness. He had nothing really to nurture. His master was gone. He had no really communication or association or fellowship. I could give you all kinds of, because I keep lists of these statues. Yeah, well, I could take you to Japan or Scotland, and you know about them too, about these that show great loneliness. And it has a dire consequences sometimes. I have a friend who had two gerbils. Well, she really married this fellow who had two gerbils, but she married them in a way. And they'd let the gerbils out at night. They're a Mongolian rodent. And she became quite attached to these gerbils. They had to be careful about saying, well, it's time to get the gerbils in, because then they'd go and hide. One night, when one was 7 and the other 9, both males, she didn't notice that the curious one, as she opened the refrigerator door, jumped up on the ledge. And she closed the door, killing him. And the other refused feed and died in 2 days. I can give you that for other animals. So it has very serious consequences. Now, in my training, of course, I learned germ theory. And as I referred to last week, we've had a dichotomy for a long time. In the early days, the church made a deal with the scientists and said, you take care of the body, we'll take care of the mind. And forever they were separated. For a long time, in a way. Some character came along that really shook up the troops after 350 years, from the Renaissance 1500 to about the middle of the 1800s. His name was Charles Darwin. He proposed that man evolved from lower species. And that really shook up the troops. And the natives have been restless ever since. And they're still restless, as Larry Collins articulated so well on last Friday. They're still very restless, and they're at each other's throat, those who have differing views on this. And he pointed out that the difference between man and animals is not as great as people first thought. He also proposed that the expression of emotions in higher animals, such as dogs and monkeys, was strikingly similar to the way people expressed emotions. His views were briefly contested, but scientists picked up on this and began studying emotions in dogs and other animals, which up to that point was peculiar to human beings. And if Darwin's Descent of Man wasn't enough in 1871, the next year he came out with The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, in which he outlined a radically new idea about human feelings. He stated that human beings' way of expressing emotions was very similar, if not identical, to that of lower animals. Therefore, biomedical scientists should study emotions, not theologians and other people. And that really shook up the troops, too. But he says emotions were serviceable habits and were expressed in a manner designed to effectively communicate to others what was being felt inside. Emotional expressions served definite purposes, but mobilized the animal into definite courses of action or communicated a special message. And I'll have more to say about this on Saturday morning when we We talk about communication in animals. Emotions expressed in similar ways among all animals, but sort of their means of expression. Like animals are easier to figure out if they're suffering from loneliness than people are. He made another important pronouncement which has been generally ignored by scientists. Darwin stated that the emotion of love was an exception to all the general rules. It was the strongest of all emotions. Yet it was the only one that had no peculiar means of expression. He struggled to arrive at a means of describing emotional love. And I'll read you that. Although the emotion of love, for instance, that of a mother for her infant, is one of the strongest of which the mind is capable, it can hardly be said to have any proper or peculiar means of expression. And this is intelligible, as it has not habitually led to any special line of action. A strong desire to touch the beloved person is commonly felt. Love is expressed by this means more plainly than any other. We probably owe the desire to inherited habit, in association with nursing and tending our children, with mutual caress of lovers. With the lower animals, we see the same principle of pleasure derived by from contact and association with love. You see that with the chief's hearing dog, my wife, I call her the chief. Dogs and cats manifestly take pleasure in rubbing against their masters and mistresses, and in being rubbed and patted by them. Thus, according to Darwin, love is the most difficult of all emotions to study because it has no clear means of expression. And if you can't measure it, scientists ignore it. And he struggled to arrive at a means of describing this, as I mentioned. Darwin's work had a great impact on many people. I mean, if it wouldn't have been for him, you'd never heard of Freud, probably. But the remarkable impact it made was on two physiologists. And as a physiologist, you see, I have to show that I know at least two physiologists. And we've got to brag about knowing a couple of physiologists. I met neither of them. But one of them is Pavlov, who operated in Leningrad, and a guy named Walter B. Kynan, who's at Harvard. And both had done very pioneering research work of the heart and had published textbooks demonstrating that physiological processes, you know, how we function, are influenced by emotional states and affected by the way we think and feel, and set the pattern for such studies. And up to that point, it was almost rank heresy, you see. But they were famous people. But both neglected the emotion of love, which Darwin labeled the strongest of which the mind is capable. Walter Buchanan put out a book in 1929, Bodily Changes in Pain, Hunger, Fear, and Rage. The effect of emotion on heart and other organs. Darwin, of course, had discussed five. These and love. Cannon described vividly the effects of petting and human handling on physiological functioning of various organ systems. He had no context in which to place them. He labeled them remarkable perturbations. And they are. And simply noted this in passing. Cannon appreciated the emotion of love, but he didn't have the methodology to describe, to measure. Pavlov, who was a Nobel Prize winner, And turn that on. Everybody got introduced into Pavlov. Our older daughter, Karin, made this drawing of him when she was in high school. I was giving a lecture about pigs, and so she did this. Now, almost everybody knows about Pavlov. He was the first physiologist to get a Nobel Prize and the first Russian. So he's big potatoes. And he was very concerned with the unnatural manner in which animal organ systems were studied. You see, he wanted to work on a dog that was intact. Up to that point, you know, they'd cut off something or cut out something, and you didn't really then have a normal dog. Now, he did intervene here. Now, he picked dogs, not pigs. He thought all pigs were hysterical and wouldn't allow them in their lab, which set us back many years, but I won't go into that now. He liked dogs. And dogs liked him. In fact, there's a statue out in front of his laboratory, great big tall dog. And what he did, and what made him so famous, is that he set up an experiment, a very interesting one, to try to get at this whole thing. He would He would monitor organ systems continuously without affecting really the health of the animal. And he developed a surgical, constructed fistula into the stomach. It isn't what you think it is there. And he called it the Pavlov pouch, which every self-respecting physiologist knows, and many high school students know it. And what he did, he'd feed the dog, and then in about three and a half, he'd feed him meats, for example, and in about 3 or 4 minutes, he'd check the digestive juices coming out, you see, the result of feeding. And then he kept repeating the experiment, and it was shortening the time. Those digestive juices appear much sooner. Before he even gave meat, the appearance of people, a person coming. It shortened it, so it messed up the detail, you see. I mean, you can't run experiments this way. And so what he did then, noticing that the person caused the dogs to secrete, in fact, of all the phenomena studied, nothing was more powerful than human contact. So he went on to develop an isolation chamber, the Pavlovian chamber, for which he also gained a lot of notoriety. What was that for? To eliminate the influence of people and other environmental phenomena. Now, most everyone knows about this. He went on then, you see, you keep the people out, and then you feed the animal, then you ring a bell. Then you found out you didn't have to feed them. You just rung the bell and the same juices would come out. And that's what most people know about Pavlov, as what Karn has depicted there. Now, other isolation means were selected. Some of you have done studied psychology. You know about the Skinnerian box. So you can avoid human contact, while emotional states such as hunger, pain, fear, and rage, but not love, could be studied in great detail. The power of human contact, of fellowship and community, is overwhelming, but since you can't measure it, it's hard to study. Now, what happened here? Hoover, you've all heard of Herbert Hoover, and he was very much involved after the war in Russia and in Europe, helping the people after the war. And he picked out a physician named Gant, Horsley Gant, who went over there, and he met old Pavlov. And I guess in a way, lucky for Pavlov, he worked in his laboratory for 7 years and translated a lot of his stuff from Russian. So Pavlov became very well known. And then what Gant did, he brought these techniques back to Johns Hopkins, and he began to use chambers for what they were built to exclude, human contact. And Gant came to realize that human contact was one of the most potent influences on the cardiac system. And after much study, I got to read you something else here. What he did in studying this, putting him into this special chamber, when alone, the dog's heart rate was quite rapid, that he was suffering from loneliness in this chamber, see, separated from everything, varying from 120 to 160 beats per minute, where probably an ambient in this situation would be about 100. Immediately after the person entered the room, depending, of course, on the dog, when the person entered the room, the heart rate would decrease 20 to 30 beats per second, per minute, I mean, and with the approach of a person would fall even more. During petting, the heart rate fell to the lowest level during the entire session, which was, in many experiments, in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 beats per minute. Another procedure used at times involved a person entering a room and sitting next to the dog throughout the session. Then the person would pet the dog for 2 or 3 minute intervals for 60 seconds each trial, 5 to 10 trials per session. On that occasion, his heart would be remarkably lower and less variable while the person was in the chamber than when the dog was alone. And during the petting, the heart rate would go as low as 20 to 30 beats per minute. He almost worried whether he's going to quit, give it all up. In addition, on several occasions, our heart rate slowed to the extent there was sinus arrest. That is, the heart would pause for 6 or 8 seconds. Several occasions when blood pressure was measured, it fell from 140 millimeters systolic while the dog was alone to 75, almost half of that, during petting. And to Lynch's knowledge, heart rate and blood pressure changes of this magnitude are among the most marked that have ever been reported in the dog under any condition short of seriously injuring or killing the animal. And while this particular dog routinely showed these major cardiac changes to human contact, nevertheless lived for 14 years in the laboratory. Well, And then what happened, Gant said that two of the most ordinary aspects of human contact, that is, human presence and human petting, was most potent effect on the dogs. And the entrance, but in his situation then, he carried it on, and he knows that just the entrance of a person into the room, there was 20 or 30 beats, would increase, but then on petting it go down to 10 to 30 beats per minute. Other workers at Johns Hopkins noted human contact could markedly affect coronary blood flow, and it's about as effective as violent exercise on a treadmill. So that ought to impress you. Now Lynch, the fellow that wrote this book, on the medical consequences of loneliness, joined Gant, and he started electric shock treatments, which isn't my favorite recommendation, on treatments on dogs, and they'd give them to unannounced, and of course the blood, the heart rate would go way up. And then they gave a warning signal 10 seconds before they were going to do it. Then it about doubled, went 100 to 200. And then what he did, in the first instance, you know, he put a person in there, and then they'd shock him, and he figured, well, maybe that he warned a person, you know, it may bite you. Huh? But no, the blood pressure went all down. And then they gave the warning signal, and he put him in there with that. And petting throughout essentially eliminated, in fact, sometimes decreased the heart rate of what it would have been, even in the presence of this stimulus, which otherwise would double the heart rate. Now, can you reverse this thing and show the similarity? Well, the truth of the matter, you can. By the presence of an animal, you can reduce the blood pressure of the person. In fact, what happened on this, I showed you a picture of the guy the other day, it's changed his whole life, it's a psychiatrist who worked with Lynch on some of these things. He was from the University of Pennsylvania. And they were doing a social inventory on people with serious heart problems and were hospitalized. And his graduate student, who was an animal person, says, why don't you ask him one other question? Do you own a pet or not? And then they did a year's follow-up and found out that of all the questions they asked him, the only thing that made any difference on survival was whether they had a pet or not. almost 30% of those that didn't have a pet were dead at the end of the year. And only 3 out of 53 that were dead that had a pet. I'm mainly emphasizing dogs today, but other animals had the same effect. Well, that caused a lot of people to sit up and take notice. And we've noticed it too. And like it at the head trauma unit at Houston, and a physician there insists that animals be brought in for the comatose people to touch the animals while they're in comatose. And for the kids that hate these procedures are really lonely. It's lonely for a child, huh, to go to these terrible, I mean, they got to take blood out of them. They're always doing these supine painful procedures. But if the dog is present, huh, they know they're not going to get hurt if the dog is there. And they'll tell you that. Or they'll take their blood shots if they can have a dog afterwards. Now, I also investigate from the standpoint of sheep. And I visited Cornell because many, many years ago, they'd take twin lambs, take one away from the mother, isolate it, keep the other one with it, and study it. And it'll make you cry to see what happened to the sheep. The sheep, I mean, it never did well. It was a basket case. The same thing happened at Wisconsin with Harlow with the monkeys. Remember, he separated them out from the mother. He gave some of them a terry towel on a screen, another one's just a screen. And the terry cloth helped a little bit. But they also were basket cases. When you separate them from human contact, it's serious. Yeah, it's serious. Now, a few more things. Lynch said that this book is about life and death, love and companionship and health and loneliness that can break the human heart. And in his book, he wishes to document the fact that reflected in our hearts, there is a biological basis for our need to form loving human relationships If we fail to fill that need, or fail, if we fail to fulfill that need, our health is in peril. And I think it's well if I read you just a few lines from his first page. There's widespread belief in our modern culture that love is a word that has no meaning. A whole generation of detached, independent, self-sufficient, non-committed individuals agree that no one really needs to get hurt in modern human relationships. You can be intimate with someone and then leave and nothing bad will happen. This book was written to document the opposite point of view. Human relationships do matter. They are desperately important to both our mental and our physical well-being. The fact is that social isolation, lack of human companionship, death or absence of parents in early childhood, sudden loss of love, the chronic human loneliness are significant contributions to premature death. And although, as we shall see, almost every cause of death is significantly influenced by human companionship, this book will concentrate chiefly on leading cause of death, heart disease. But he goes on to say, and what he does early in the book is kind of interesting. He drew a map of the United States, and then you use various kinds of shading to see what the death rate is in the various states for, say, varying diseases. And he looked at heart disease. And he was he looked at these statistics, and he was impressed with two different statistics of two neighboring states, Nevada and Utah, for the statistics of 59 and 61. He did it in 1965. Nevada had the shortest lifespan of white males and females, not only from heart disease, but almost every other cause of death. And for females, no other state could even come close. Second highest, but yet Nevada had the second highest level of education in the United States. They had the second highest level of income and the smallest black population, because the blacks live on an average 7 years a shorter period of time than the whites. At least an average of a number of doctors in hospitals very low population density. In neighboring Utah, one of the lowest death rates. On the other hand, it had one of the lowest death rates. Utah and Nevada had identical education rates for white adults, which happened to be the highest in the country. Average income in Nevada was 1,000 more than Utah, and the number of people in urban area was about equal between them. Now, another fellow studied this, and he says Utah is extremely religious, and there's very little drinking and smoking, stable lives, stable marriages, family remains strong, most inhabitants stay in Utah. Nevada is the divorce capital of the world at that time. Greater than 20% of the males, 35 to 64, were single, widowed, or divorced, or not living with their spouses. Of those married with spouses present, more than one-third had been previously widowed or divorced. And in Utah, comparable figures were about half. And so I'll just read a couple of things here for you. In summary, then, in both men and women, white and non-white, cardiovascular, including stroke and hypertension, was listed as a major cause of premature death. For divorced, widowed, and single men, both white and non-white, the overall death rates for cardiovascular disease were 2 or 3 times higher for married than for married men. Similar trends were also true for women. I've told some of these people, though, it depends a lot on who you marry. For almost every other major cause of premature death, there is also a marked increase for non-married over married, and difference in death rates is as high as tenfold. And so it goes. I want to turn it over to you, and then have some discussion before I go to some of this other. But what I tell people, it's very, very useful to me, when we deal with grieving people, as we do, and we have a support network for people who lose their animals or they lose people, in our People Pet Partnership at Washington State and University of Idaho, have what's called People by Partnership. And when I counsel with these people at time of euthanasia or death of an animal, that I warn them that with this loss, no matter what the nature of this loss is, if it's a big loss, you're far higher risk for accident. And I sometimes volunteer, should we take you home? Because you're at higher risk. You're far higher incidence of death rate among those who have suffered great loss, and your chances of getting a disease are also much greater. And that's the truth. And that's why it's going to be very important. Do you want to say something now?
Sure. for years in working with groups of people, in mostly on behalf of the church, I did an exercise in which I just put up four signs in different places of the room and asked each of the people to select one of the four, just for the moment, in which I would say, get with people, get physically busy, tell someone else, try to escape, or whatever, which was really very unimportant. And the question, the instructions were simply, when I am lonely, I usually, and then had them select one. And they would spend a lot of time on why this one and why that one, which was, of course, as they caught on eventually, not the point at all. It was simply to get people to admit that they're lonely. If you ask them, if people, how many of you get lonely? Most of them wouldn't say so. But if you say, when I'm lonely, I usually, they all go. So it's a really, it's a funny dimension. I think there's many more people today that are more aware and willing to talk about their loneliness. But I think one part of it is just to recognize and to say it. I distinguish between that and solitude. Solitude is terribly important to me. I seek it, to be alone. Back out in the world, it was my automobile. I did a lot of traveling, and the neat part was the ride to the airport. That's 1 hour in Chicago from Madison to O'Hare, and so at least 2 hours of solitude. I fell in love with some of the people at WFMT in Chicago because often it was my background music. So distinguishing that, to solve it for me, the loneliness is the thing that happens to me that I don't like or want. And for me, it's obviously most poignantly defined because of the absence of Ginny, my wife, after we lived together 35 and a half years. That was always the loneliness I feared. It was the loneliness I experienced when I traveled. It was the absence of Ginny, the touch, the taste, the smell, the whatever, anything that was related to it. So now I have a different understanding than I had all during that time about what it means to be lonely and how the avenues of, what shall we say, what's the verb? Dealing with, working with, responding to, experiencing, whatever it may be, that loneliness. I was a person who learned from Ginny to be able to tell somebody else that I'm lonely. I'm the person who quite pointedly and frequently within the last 40 minutes did this, telling somebody I need a hug, because it's part of that touch that is so important to me, and that the most important touch in my life up to this point is now gone. So I find ways to work about that personally, and I'd be glad to talk more about that, but I wanted to respond to what Leo said in terms of what we try to do here. It's not at all surprising to anybody who has thought about it at all that everybody who comes here is in some way or another lonely. The people who come here for longer periods of time tend to be more intentionally dealing with loneliness. We have names for it here. I'm in transition. Translate that. I'm lonely. It has a lot to do with job. Sure it is. But what do we do a job for? Somewhat to get money, but mostly because we have both a sense of direction and a way to interrelate with other people. We forget about that. And there's one sense in which being in transition is a fat, middle-class luxury. But in another sense, it's dealing with the whole of life, which is simply to find ways to not only comfortably, but helpfully, mutually helpfully, relate to other human beings. And that's why we grieve so much and so, I think, well. June or Carolyn here, we're busy planning our farewell party. It has nothing, or it has very little to do with June and Carolyn. We're planning a party for ourselves. We have to, because we're lonely already for June and Carolyn. That's part indeed of what we do. And that's why during the winter, when the long-term people are here, during summer it's tougher. Many of us are a little more lonely during the summer because all of you people come rushing through here and we get a touch and a taste of you and then you're gone. And we're so busy that we get tired and we don't have time to spend time talking to one another. And we're really probably much lonelier during the summertime. And we get back at it again. And I love it. I mean, I love both times. And comes April, I'm tired of the winter community. I'm ready for summer. Comes August, I'm ready for winter as well. What we've done is try to find as many ways as possible by looking for people who respond, who are sensitive to one another and to the loneliness that takes place. We don't ask them, you know, are you good in loneliness? But you discover that there are people who do that and do that well. And those are the people that we seek to keep around for a longer period of time. And we also organize small groups of doing things. There's a group meeting, I think still now, maybe they had their last meeting, for the people who are leaving. They get together and talk about leaving. That hadn't been done before. We're doing that. The people who are coming in now have small groups to get together and talk for a while. Some of that will work, some won't. Some, not everybody will buy into it, but it's an important dimension of dealing with the absence of whatever is back there for people who came, and adjusting to some kind of relationships here. And then our goal is to tie that to the faith life and the spiritual journey. We talk a lot about that's, you know, the in phrase for believing in God and for me in Jesus Christ, of course, is to be on a spiritual journey. But most of that talk too relates to the absence, the missing of intimacy, being really close to another person and being able to understand oneself better because of that, and therefore also understand other human beings better. So we spend pointed time at that. We're not good at that yet. I think we're still learning because all of us, as I implied yesterday, is that we're all learners in what community and fellowship means. I guess sometimes church just tends to teach us that like when we're adolescents, you have a party and then you've had fellowship and take care of it. And most of us certainly are looking for more than that, and I think kids certainly are. Teenagers certainly are as well. So part of the working of the place is to provide those opportunities to cut through the loneliness, to uncover it, not force it. You know, we were sitting all over here during the winter, and they're talking about different groups to have. The fella sitting about just where you were sitting said tentatively, could we have a group of shy people? He said it like that. And of course, no one responded. Until we all laughed, because what shy people are going to say, we want a group.
There's a lot of Garrison Keillors around.
Oh my, yes, indeed, indeed. And then he got to be known for the shy dimension of the village. We'd always turn to him in his shyness to let us know how will shy people respond to this. It was really neat. So finding those ways, and we do have the shy people. I'm not equating shyness with loneliness at all, but often shy people do experience a depth maybe of loneliness that we also have to be aware of. So it's that alerting, being alert to it and working to it. Why did the singles come up? We announced in one mailing, singles weekend up here, 34 people plowed through the snow, 6 feet of it, and came from Idaho and Oregon and all over Washington to come up here. And we talked about intimacy. So that's sort of the approach. And our conviction is not simply being physically present with these other people, but having ways within that presence to make connections with some other folks is what we are about. And then what we are saying whenever we can to people, you can take Holden elsewhere. That doesn't mean you have programs and buildings, but you can take what you've learned about your own loneliness and responses to it elsewhere.
I should correct something, a couple of things that come to mind, then we'll open it up. And a couple of readings. So, I said that in the concordance there's nothing on loneliness, but there is a whole column on alone. And the first one is very interesting, and O. Lynch picked up on it. He says, in the most general sense, neither the problem of human loneliness or its cure is particularly new. Even Adam, wandering about as solitary creature in the Garden of Eden, was not happy until he had a companion in his own likeness. And he went on to say, the Bible hardly begins before the creator of paradise states that it is not good for man to be alone. That's the first reference to being alone. Paradise itself was imperfect without companionship. Even God could not create a paradise devoid of companionship. And throughout history of mankind, that point has been readily acknowledged. And the other thing that I was going to mention was that you can be very lonely with a lot of people around. Mm-hmm. And this is how Paul Tournier starts out his book about this girl who is a secretary in an international welfare organization in Geneva. In fact, his first line in the book says, "And so we bid you a very pleasant good night." This girl worked in this as secretary in a very important position. She had her boss was a fine person, committed as he was to ridding the world of a serious social disease, but it was all business, you know, all business, nothing else. And she lived. Her work was in this great big. If you've been in Geneva, you know they have these great big complexes, and she didn't even have to go outside to go home. And now and then she'd run to the store, but she didn't know anybody there. And so this was her life. But every night she'd turn on this radio station that would say, "And so we bid you a very pleasant good night." To have a person say that to her, and she felt it was talking to her. And a rather strange thing happened in this office. One day a fellow from the Far East, it was an Anglican bishop who had been in the Far East and dealing with all kinds of situations. And he met the director of this welfare organization, had a long, very long talk with him. And as a result of this conversation, he had come to realize that only living faith was the real answer to man's greatest suffering. Through so many years of his series, he'd come to see the extent of such suffering. And as a result of this conversation, her boss came in one day and said one morning, and he came in with a strange look on his face. He says, "From now on," he said, "I would like God to be the real boss here and for all of us to accept leadership and authority. No welfare work can be effective unless men come to God and seek his spirit, not only in their churches, but in their homes, their offices, and their factories." So the whole complex of this whole thing changed. And he started off by essentially telling the secretary sort of where he was coming from personally and his problems, and essentially confiding in her. And then that left it open for her, and it changed the whole life of this community. What was really built is what we struggle for here, mm-hmm. is to build a community. Community of fellowship, which changed her, and that's when Tournier met her. He and his wife met her, and really delighted in her. And then this one I thought was one you got to hear before we quit and before we discuss. He said, this is Lynch, and he worked in the hospital. He works in a hospital there in Baltimore. "It seemed so familiar, and yet my feelings were so different. On the evening of late winter's day in 1976, A 75-year-old man lay in bed in an intensive care unit with his wife standing quietly beside him, gently stroking his hand while a flash of each heartbeat on the nurse's central monitoring station traced out the fact that he had a severe heart attack earlier that morning. His electrocardiogram was markedly abnormal. Runs of arrhythmic heartbeats caused a warning light, red light, to flash brightly but ominously on the monitor, while intravenous needles dripped fluid into both his arms in a frantic effort to stave off the inevitable. For several hours before his life ended, my father knew he was going to die, and he had only one simple request, that his wife of almost 48 years, my mother, stay by his side. The pain from a heart that sorely ached for lack of oxygen made it difficult for him to speak, but between them, words were not necessary. She gently stroked his hand for hours as his body temperature slowly dropped until late in the evening he died peacefully, ending a lifetime of exquisite dialogue. The grief etched in my mother's face was the price of commitment that knew no limits. The next time I entered the university hospital, I was back at work at the University Medical School. And the first patient I saw was my coronary care nursing research assistant, who was sitting up in bed, tenderly holding her one-day-old son, her firstborn child. She, too, was gently stroking a human being on the arm. He, too, could not speak, and between them, words were equally unnecessary. The joy, pride, and peace that caused her to sparkle marked the beginning of life of dialogue that also would know no limits. And within a brief time, I'd come full circle, first witnessing the death of a person loved deeply, then witnessing life renewed. Common to both was human love, and in both cases, its expression did not need spoken words. The essence of both of these encounters was dialogue, nonverbal dialogue, communication between those who are alive and in love. And it brings out an elixir. Starting as a lifeless body of my father in the hospital, staring at the lifeless body of my father in the hospital, I knew that what had been lost. No longer could we verbally communicate with each other. Our physical dialogue had come to an end. Between mother and child, it was also clear what had been born, a dialogue of love between two living persons. This book has ranged over a large number of social situations that influence the heart. Now it's near the end of his book. From a quiet comforting of a dying person to a cuddling of an infant. In our earliest years in adulthood, whether single, widowed, divorced, or married, whether neurotic, schizophrenic, or normal, or whether human or animal, one factor unites all of us, and that is dialogue, which you're about here, you see. Dialogue is the essential element of every social interaction. It is the elixir of life. The wasting away of children, the broken hearts of adults, the proportionately higher death rates of single, widowed, and divorced individuals common to all these situations, I believe, is a breakdown in the dialogue. The elixir of life sometimes dries up, and without it, people begin to wither away and die. Those who lack the dialogue early in life can perish quickly. And boy, that's the truth. While those who lose it as children, adolescents, or adults feel acutely what they have lost and struggle to get it back. And the other thing is just one passing thing. I forgot to mention that I told you about the dogs that were shocked. And when you had somebody there, you know, it didn't affect their blood pressure and heart rate. So they tried this on people, did the same thing to them as they did to the dogs. And the human contact did the same thing for them, the so-called normal ones, but it didn't do it for the schizophrenics. They got worse when the person was there. Come on, here, Steve. All right.
Leo, I have a question. I kind of have a problem, though, with encouraging humans to turn to animals for that affection and that attention, because, first of all, it seems like there's a lot of other cultures who don't have that same kind of relationship with animals, that they need to always be having animals around, because since they live more in community, they get that from each other. And it seems like in our society, there are so many things that perpetuate us living isolated lives that, in some ways, turning to animals can help people live longer or maybe be in better health, but it doesn't really help human relationship as much. And it doesn't really address the problem of us not knowing how to be affectionate with each other in non-sexual ways. In C.S. Lewis's book, The Four Loves, he talks about affection as a really basic thing that all humans need, that is non-sexual touching between sexes and between people. And this whole idea of non-sexual touching is not very well known. It's not very well understood in our society that people of the opposite sex can touch each other in affectionate ways. You know, and it seems like, I guess I have a problem with the idea of turning too much to animals, because it continues to keep the gap between humans there.
Yeah. Do you want to repeat that for this little mic?
Yeah. Oh boy. The question, and I want to do justice to it, because that's the kind of questions I like in my business, to make some very important points. And the question has to do with if one becomes very dependent and seeks out animals for their touching and for their companionship and for their as confessors and so forth, doesn't that keep people from associating? And I'm pleased to address that. As far as animals, we throughout our history, except for the last few hundred years, have been closely associated with our natural environment, animals, and people. To the extent that you and I are nurturing, we are healthy. When we have lost the objects of nurture, we are no longer healthy. With urbanization and movement and industrialization and mechanized agriculture, everybody moved off the farm. Most of the people are urbanized. They no longer have access to the natural environment. They no longer have, at least up to half, have no access to animals. And more people are living alone without objects of nurture. And those who live on the farm, it's pretty much a mechanized thing. So we, in our society, in the last few hundred years, have lost our object of nurture, and we're paying a big price for that. And I, as one who has visited nursing homes all my life, but more recently, because that's where most of all my old girlfriends are, I have seen this. And one of the principal things that an animal does for one is help them socialize. One of my friends from Cambridge did a study with his friend in a park in London. And they kept track of the extent of socialization within the park. People with baby buggies, and I assume there were babies in them. And people with dogs, and then people without either one. Who do you think socialized, who were socialized the most? Not the baby buggies, no. The dogs were first, the people with animals. Because they are a supplement, and that's what worries you, they are now a replacement. And maybe it's unfortunate they have to be a replacement. But I've talked to so many people in nursing homes, and I could show you pictures of these people. They're sitting there like this, staring at a wall or sleeping, waiting to die because nobody needs them. Their story is that many people, they have probably relatives in that whole area which they hardly ever come to see them. I visited some that I was the only one, and I didn't know them from a gooseberry. And many of their stories went something like this. I was living happily, independent in my home, with my animals, good life, and I either ran out of money, or so I had to go to government housing, which didn't permit animals, or some people laid a guilt trip on me and says, you know, I really worry about you here living with these animals, you're going to fall down, and then, oh boy, you know, I'll never forgive myself. Nobody will find you. So they take them to a nice nursing home where no animals are allowed. And the kindest thing they could have done with them is to euthanize them along with their animals. So there are people, and I can list people who are pathologically bonded. But unfortunately in our society, that's why so many people are turning to animals. But in my business, what I've seen is that they are what I call pet-facilitated therapy. They're an adjunct. What we have done in most of your life, and a little longer, not totally in my life, because when I was growing up, the prisons had the animals there. They had the farm flocks. They were essentially self-sufficient from this standpoint. I judged cattle at the mental hospital in the prisons. The nursing homes and the convalescent homes were associated usually with a farm. If you look in the Midwest and all, the old people's homes had farms associated with them. When my father went to Josephine Sunset Home in Stanwood, Washington, the farm was no longer gone. Animals were not allowed there to an agrarian population. So that's why we started what we did in the Delta Society, and in my own area, the people had partnership. And we've, Schweitzer was right. I mean, what did Schweitzer do? You came to his hospital in Lamborghini. You came with your family and the animals, because it's interesting that they have done 4 surveys I'm familiar with. Where is the animal in your family? From 1 survey, 70%, another 80%, another one 98.7%, and the other one 99% said the animal is a member of the family. Of course, any child, it'd be 100%, because they don't make the distinction. They don't distinguish between members of family and animals. They're all members of family. And when you ask these people, who is the, you know, where is, what member of the family is it? It's a child, in most cases. And I'm here to tell you, and I've seen these people, I get calls all the time, you know, people lost their animal. And it's a child, and having lost a child, I can tell you it's the ultimate of tragedy. And if on July 17th, 1983, seeing me grieve for a long time afterward and still grieve, say, well, what are you grieving about? It was just a daughter. Many of you have probably said to people who are grieving over the loss of an animal, what are you grieving about? It was just a cat. It was just a dog. That's like telling me it was just a daughter. And I want you to be alert for that. Now, much of what you're saying is, it is a condemnation or a social structure. I think they should have people and animals. That's why I'm so pleased with a veterinarian down in Boise who teamed up with a nurse. They go out and get lonely children, the latchkey children, huh? Mm-hmm. And 4-H'ers. They bring them in, teach them about animals, about how you take care of animals. And then they tape up their hands, put dark glasses on them, and put cotton in their ears, and then have them uncap bottles and learn what it is to be old, huh? And then they're ready, and they can take the animal down to the nursing home and visit the old people. There's nothing better than children and old people to visit. When I get to be dictator, you're going to have the sheep out there. I visited Dillon, Montana recently. I had this letter from a picture from this girl. She couldn't have room for her 4-H lamb, so they took her down to the Convalescent Nursing Home in downtown Dillon, where they had a lot of room. And what is the Dillon Nursing Home full of? Old sheep herders. Huh? So she's down there and learning more about sheep than what she bargained for, but it was great for the sheep herders. And then I was so interested in it, I went over there next summer, and then she had 2 sheep. She'd also gotten a dog for the manager and named it after him, so he couldn't very well get rid of it. And the end 2 rooms of this nursing home, what is it? It's a daycare center. Not a better combination than that. That's what I want to do. I want to go out with animals as Jesus came into this world, with animals. So let us look at the whole family, the whole community. And every healthy community has caring people and animals. And that's why, for example, I can tell you about the Children's Hospital in Denver. I mean, the cancer ward. Physicians will now want them in there. They've extended to all the wards except in intensive care and newborn. Me on more than I give you 4 hours of lecture on this. And 1,000 slides. Yes.
The opposite side of the coin for loneliness is commitment. And
is what?
Commitment. It's troublesome, and it's sad to see so many lonely people. And we talk and we talk and we talk and we talk. On the other hand, I see and hear a lot of people who are lonely. And they often will say, I'm lonely. And no way will you get them to make a serious commitment longer than the first small inconvenience. And I think that's really sad. I don't know how you get around that.
Well, I could tell you some of my experiences with lonely people with animals. Sometimes they get committed to an animal. It sure helps. And the other part of this, we're going to discuss it Friday evening, is vital to opening up relationship and loneliness. I mean, it doesn't particularly address it, is forgiveness. It has a remarkable effect. Many people are lonely because they live in resentment and seeking revenge rather than forgiving away. But commitment is vital.
Mm-hmm.
And the meaning, as you mentioned the other day, you know,
sure.
Life without meaning is loneliness. And that's why nurturing is so important. We've got to be in a nurturing posture by our construct. Now, I should say that some people aren't animal people in our present day. And we also have to respect them, as we do in the Tacoma Lutheran Home. And I mentioned it to some of you, which is one of the model places in the West, probably anywhere. And I always say, you know, I believe in fairness, that those people who do not want exposure to animals shouldn't have to have exposure. And those who want, they should also have that privilege. Up till now, they haven't been, until President Reagan signed the bill in 1983. It wasn't promulgated until a few months ago, but you couldn't have animals in nursing homes, convalescent homes that are federally subsidized. That's for handicapped and old people. But when they brought the cats in Tacoma Lutheran homes, and those people didn't want exposure to the cats, they issued them squirt guns. So the people that were sitting there like this, you know, boy, they got their squirt gun ready, and for that cat to come down that hallway, boy, and they're ready to go. They're alert. You know? And those cats are smart, you know. One spray, and that's the end of that room. You know? They're not going to visit that room.